everybody. Welcome to what is episode 88 of the Alexis L podcast. 88, of course, an interesting number. We think immediately when we think 88, we think of the German Acht, the famous flat gun, which was later adapted as a formidable anti-tank weapon, the 88mm Fleckpanzer, which also, of course, equipped the King Tiger, the Tiger II tank, legendary 88, the only weapon, any anti-tank weapon that the Allies really feared.
Bloody hell.
Acht, 88mm.
That's what directors keep telling me on set. So they're talking about those tanks, are they?
Right.
When they say cut, act, oh, act.
Right. Act.
They're talking about tanks. Oh, right. I saw.
Anti-tank gun. Anti-tank. It was an anti-tank
gun. Well, sorry. So excuse me for zoning out while you talked about military equipment. But it's also an angel number, Alexi. Do you believe in angel numbers?
Of course I don't.
Well, 88
it's
is
lucky
a sign
in Chinese as well, isn't it? I think 8 is a lucky number in Chinese.
It's a sign of great success, abundance, and prosperity. So this is the episode that's going to make us rich.
Yeah, this is going to finally put us over the top.
But I have to apologize for last week because you said it was episode 86 after asking me what episode it was. And I told you 86 and I'm an idiot. The explanation is too boring as to why I got that number wrong, but we got it wrong. So in case you're out there confused why we've skipped a number, last week was 87.
That's what people are worrying about right now.
I'm sure. Yeah.
The nomenclature, the ordering, well, the numerical ordering of.
What are people worrying about, Alexi?
Well, they should be worrying about bloody free speech. We're recording this on Tuesday because you're going to Glastonbury. I attended a demonstration yesterday in Trafalgar Square in support of Palestine Action. That is a cause that we have supported and we have supported financially, which on Friday, awful woman, married to an even worse husband, Yvette Cooper, gets her way, will be considered a terrorist organization, Palestine. And this is it's hard to overstate what an enormous dint this is, what an enormous attack this is. You hearing, Wilf?
No.
Oh, okay.
Hello, Wilf.
Hello, Wilf.
There he is. An attack on...
Wolf's attacking my free speech. Well, an enormous, extraordinary attack on free speech, this is. And our democracy, really. To say that Palestine Action are the same as ISIS or Boko Haram is ridiculous. Yvette Cooper says she is taking consultations. The people she is taking consultations from are people like We Believe in Israel, Luke Akers' Israeli lobby organization, the campaign against anti-Semitism, which is not a campaign against anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. It's a campaign entirely for the interests of the genocidal apartheid state of Israel. And also a character called Lord Walney, formerly known as the Labour MP John Woodcock. And he was for a while government under Boris Johnson, and then they kept him on for a while under Labour, extremism czar or something. And he strove mightily at that point to have the entirely peaceful demonstrations against Israel's genocide banned in central London. He didn't get his way, but I was on Channel 4 News last night, interviewed at the demonstration. And Lord Woodcock was on before me telling lies, saying that Palestine Action were violent. Of course, they are. The whole point is that they are non-violent, and they exist in as a group, Direct Action, who have antecedents. Obviously, everybody mentions the suffragettes, the civil rights campaigns in the United States, action to break up sporting events against apartheid Israel.
Yep.
What they are not is Boko fucking Haram. And I don't know. I mean, from Friday, if I express these opinions and if the bill goes through, I will be breaking the law and I could go to prison for 14 years. The guy from Simeon Brown from Channel 4 News asked me, he said, you know, well, you know, it might be illegal for you to express these opinions on Friday. What are they doing? I said, well, I don't know. I said, I'm not a brave man. I'm easily intimidated. But I will, in fact, I think, carry on expressing these views to try and point out the ludicrous, chilling effect that this will have on free speech. Yvette Cooper is a fucking arsehole. David Lammy is an arsehole. Keir Starmer is an arsehole. They are repressive freaking arseholes. And, of course, ironically, of course, Starmer, in 20 years ago, defended people who actually did that and got them, who had damaged aircraft and got them off. But this is, I can't tell you how, what a big leap this is on the road to fascism, to repression. It needs to be resisted on all levels. And the only people who are, you know, advocating for it are hideous apologists for genocide and ethnic cleansing and the murder of children. Mm. John Woodcock, Lord Walney. That's the man that the Labour government, a Labour government, for God's sake, a Labour fucking government is taking advice from. Weirdo. 50-year-old man with the face of a 2-year-old child. Extraordinary shitbag.
And who's Yvette Cooper's husband?
Fucking Ed Balls. Dipshit.
No. Oh, fucking
good, what is it? Good Morning Britain presenter.
Yeah.
As he is now. Fuck back.
Imagine like aspiring to be like Piers Morgan. That's all I
Yeah, well, Piers Morgan's, I mean, God knows we're in such a bloody world, but I know Piers Morgan still, you know, from time to time. But he was, you know, Piers Morgan can be, has the possibility of being all right. Somebody like Ed Balls is never all right. It is, I can't tell you how dangerous I think these actions are.
It's always been, you know, you expect them to arrest people who are doing these actions. You expect them to harass them and... But to prescribe them as a terrorist group is such a huge leap.
It is massive.
And like you're saying, like to lump them in with like actual terrorism whilst holding the hand and fully fledged support of a nation, a colony that is actively performing colonial terrorist acts.
Yeah.
And you know, killing kids, which they are still doing, which everyone has... paused talking or thinking about while this whole, you know, Iran skirmish is happening.
Yeah.
They're ignoring the hundreds and hundreds of people that are being killed.
Over 500 they've killed since last 10 days.
Just while they're trying to get food, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the humiliating act of begging for handouts is already, you know, there's already a terrorist fucking act making them beg like that. And you see these... They're making them into hordes of fucking zombies, you know, rushing to go and get handouts of. And if you've seen inside these packs they're getting, it's like sometimes rotten food, broken packaging. All the food is just mixed into one mulch, like a Hungarian goulash in this burlap sack that they have to carry for miles and miles. And then separate grains of rice from like the flour and the sugar and just to make a bit of bread for their kids, you know. And it's
they've weaponized
and they're shooting them on top and of all shooting, that.
Yeah, they've weaponized this. Given you know, given
I saw a disgusting article saying, despite the desperate situation, the GMO is it called the GMO?
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF.
Despite all this. Desperation, the GHF movement is working. And I'm like, fuck off.
No, it's a fuck. I mean, the sadism, the calculated sadism of the Israelis, of the Israeli armed forces, and I'm sorry to say, the Israeli people, the fascistic denial of humanity to Palestinian people, in fact, to anybody who's not Israeli, I suspect, is absolutely the worst. And it is comparable with any human act of depravity that has ever been committed in the history of the world. behavior of Israel and its armed forces right now is comparable with any of that. The absolute worst. And this is what Yvette Cooper, their arms industry, Elbit Systems, and their genocide is what, you know, is what Yvette Cooper is going to freeze our, you know, is going to attack our democracy on the basis of reports she's had from people who are in favor of this ethnic cleansing, people who are in favor of the murder of children. It is beyond disgusting. It's, you know, it's chilling, really. So anyway, see you from Belmarsh. We'll be doing the next podcast from Belmarsh.
Folsom Prism style.
We'll
do a live podcast in the canteen. In the
At least I'm not.
Well, they'll come for me first, Alexei, because I'm not a public figure. Or maybe they'll, they'll make an example of you.
They may do. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it's genuine. I mean, We'll see, really. I mean, they may choose to leave me alone, but I'm not going to stop talking. If you have a conversation, as I understand, they're misuse of the terror laws. You say, why, if you just ask the question, why is Hezbollah, why are Hamas proscribed organizations? A friend of mine who's in the Foreign Office said that they weren't. They were regarded as resistance organizations until, I think, the early part of this century, or late 20th century, until the Israelis persuaded them to change it, you know. But the Hezbollah, Hamas, they don't attack. I mean, I'm just asking for clarification here. I'm not supporting Hamas or Hezbollah. I'm just asking why they should be, why we should consider them proscribed if they've got nothing against us. They should have, but they haven't.
I just display such a narrow field of view because, Hamas and Hezbollah, you know, I'm not signing up to join them, and it's they use terrorist,
we're not Matt Keane.
They use terrorist methods and stuff. But the wider picture is that they are a symptom of an oppressive imperialist colony that has been forced upon a people.
They are resistance organizations. You might not like them, but they are resistance groups.
And they're forced to use these methods because they don't have an army. They don't have military equipment to the same standard as an army. And I don't have to overburden the point that I'm not agreeing with murdering innocent people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I shouldn't have to say that. But the wider intellectual point of view is that they are a result of an oppression of an entire people. And if these people were left alone, they wouldn't ever feel the need for these groups. And Palestine Action Just Stop Oil even, you know, are a result of us being en masse gaslit by our government, being told that capitalism and imperialism is the way forward and the only way of existence for us civilized Westerners.
Absolutely.
And we're sitting here thinking, am I crazy or is the world crazy? How can we let this go on? And some people have the courage and the tenacity to actually go and disrupt the arms industry in such a way that actually makes an effect, which is the only reason that they're being classed as terrorism, because it has an effect. Unlike Just Stop Oil, who are doing the same thing. They're pouring beans on sculptures and paintings and you know, gluing themselves to the pavement, but everyone hates them. And they're not as effective.
I don't think they do, but the right wing, our billionaire owned press and our shitbag owned and shitbag controlled.
Yes. Totally vilify them.
BBC and ITV vilify them.
Where it's like, the oil industry is the villain here. You know, a grandma who's glued herself to a bridge.
No, absolutely. Absolutely not. And Stephen Capos, our friend Stephen Capos, the Holocaust survivor from Hungary, was on the demonstration. I saw him being interviewed. I think it was on Novara rather than Legacy Media. But he was saying, you know, we can't all be heroes, but we should. The people who are, the people who sacrifice themselves for us, for our collective good, should be applauded. And that is Palestine Action. And that is, as you say, Just Stop Oil.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I didn't mean to give the impression I don't like Just Stop Oil. I agree with what they do, you know.
Yeah.
As you know, I'm a woodcrafter through and through, woodcraft folk. what did you call them?
The paramilitary wing of the co-op.
There you go.
All right. Shall we throw to our main segment of the podcast?
Yeah, we've got a really interesting interview, which you very cleverly arranged from a park somewhere in Kurdish, northern
Kurdistan.
Kurdistan, northern Turkey.
Sebi Bikes,
with the man who's cycling around the world was just cycling around the world, really.
Yeah.
But he's got some really interesting points to make. And treats some of my idiotic questions with tremendous good humor.
And your accent.
And my Dutch, yes. He's
Dutch
is,
and you were doing a Dutch accent. Board. I was like cringy at that.
You know,
you get away with it, I guess, because of your age, I have to say. I'm so sorry.
That's the only reason I get away with this.
You just meet someone and start doing their accent at them. Although I did see an interview with a Japanese person saying they like it when tourists ask them questions in a Japanese accent.
Where is
McDonald's? Because you know, there was a white person saying, is it cringe to do that? And is it offensive? And he's like, actually, no. It's really useful because that's how I would say McDonald's.
All right, okay.
So
a McDonald's.
I wouldn't
give me free rein. Yeah, I used to do a bit. It's in Sandwich Bar somewhere about how when I was in Chinese restaurants, because I would like to be able to speak. You know, I use the three words of Arabic that I know constantly with you. I would like to be able to speak Chinese. So I used to, in Chinese restaurants, put on a Chinese accent and say, give me the fried noodle and a mixed meat fried noodle, please.
But there's a functionality to it because you're trying to exchange information.
It's not racism.
The intention is important.
Do you do a dim sum?
Okay, stop. The intention and functionality is important, not just
shumai.
All right, can we throw to the interview, please?
All right, Sebi Bikes. This was initiated by Talal, and it's Sebi Cycles. And Sebastian is cycling around the world. And but more than that, tell us your story, please.
Yeah, Sebi Cycles, aka
Sebi Bikes. Sebi Bikes.
Sebi Bikes. You confused me. You said it before, Sebi Bikes.
Well, I mean, I guess the premise is the same. Yeah. So. Now would be the moment where you want me to say what I'm up to.
Yeah, please.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So, for the last year, I am on my bike that, if people can watch, is right behind me, cycling against borders. I have a little flag sticking out from the back of my bike, which is cycling against borders, because I'm trying to. Well, first, I wanted to get to India. Now, I think it's going to be Japan. But I want to get there and talk about passport privilege because my Dutch passport is the third strongest in the world. I can basically go anywhere. But for example, I was just in Iraq a couple days ago and they have one of the worst passports in the world. And so, yeah, I was just trying to learn about borders. Why are they there? What kind of world do they make and how do we fight them?
Yeah, well, it's something, I suppose. I know that, for instance, Öcalan, the kind of Kurdish theorist and the founder of the PKK, turned against violence. He sees a lot of the world's problems has really been related to the nation state. Would you? I guess you are of the same opinion.
Yeah, funny story about Öcalan. I just got a haircut like 3 hours ago, and there were like 10 guys with very clean-shaven heads, and we started talking about the fact that they're Kurdish. And turns out there was a big shrine in the corner of the barbershop just dedicated to Abdullah Öcalan.
Really?
Yeah.
We should point out you're in a park somewhere in Turkey, which is, I mean, miraculous.
Yeah, or northern Kurdistan. Northern Kurdistan.
What town are you? What's the name of the town you're in?
Sirt. It's about 100 kilometers from the Iraqi border. I'm now 3 days ago that I was there.
Actually, just dive it. What give us the technical spec of your bike, really? Years ago, I actually had the rally bikes. If you know, they made me a bike when I was really famous, and it was I think it was the one that Joep Zoetemelk won the Tour de France on. Is that right?
I think Joep Zoetemelk is also how all the podcasters and announcers would say his name. Yeah, so actually I'm sorry to disappoint that I'm not a big bike guy, but I'm learning.
Yeah.
But I think this is a Canadian company, Kona. And
Kona, just, yeah, I think I've got a Kona. It's I think they're Korean. Oh, yeah. They Korean? Yeah, I've got a Kona. Korean? That's amazing. So it's just like a pretty basic kind of alloy.
Yeah, it's a steel hybrid bike, so it weighs like insanely heavy. But yeah. I figured it was probably better for it to be steel, because in case something breaks, then you know, wherever I am in the world, they can weld it. And it's just like the most stock components, you know, like no hydro Shimano brakes.
Yeah.
Just like super basic.
I think that's this is a terrible doubt. I remember reading a book years ago, which was fascinating, called The World Beneath My Wheels. And it was written by, I can't remember his name, but it was a German prisoner of war who, after the war, decided to ride around the world. And obviously in the 1940s, in a very basic steel bicycle. But there's a scene I remember. I understand that an Egyptian, I think it's an Egyptian customs officer or something, tries to get a bribe off him, and he won't pay, so he jumps on his bike and rides off. And then the Egyptian jumps on his bike and chases him. So there's these two guys on these really basic steel, and the chase goes on all night. They chase each other across possibly the Sinai Desert all night. It's sort of like a nightmare. I don't know whether you must have had a lot of adventures, really.
Yeah, although my crossings of borders have basically always gone incredibly smooth. You know, like they look at my blue eyes and my Dutch passport, and I'm never searched. I never have any questioning. It's pretty remarkable, actually, like the level of privilege that I carry with me around the street.
Yeah, I remember all the Palestinians I know, they all wanted to marry an Irish girl because they thought that was the passport.
Mm.
But also probably maybe more, I mean, it's different now, but in the days of hijackings, it was also probably the most hijacking proof. You know, you could, if they hijacked a plane, you could say, look, I'm Irish. And they say, oh, you're all right, you can get off.
I mean, Irish is same passport strength as
really?
As Dutch. Yeah.
How's the UK passport? What was that?
Dutch, I can go to 121 countries without a visa. I can just roll up. And UK is 114.
So slightly less. Yeah, well, would you want us in your country? I would. So particularly you've been in places like Iraq where many people would forswear to go, I suppose. What was that like?
Well, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, they've been incredibly lovely countries. I was in Damascus for 3 weeks. I was absolutely blown away by the Syrian people. I have never witnessed something like this, especially as a Dutchie. Yeah. Holy moly. It was really remarkable.
Do they still have that? Because when I was there, they have that. Every bottle of beer is slightly different. You get lots of beer with kind of sediment in it. It's very light. I don't know. It wasn't sort of standardized, really.
Yeah, and it's also true that now that al-Sharaa is in power, there's less and less alcohol being served. I spoke to quite some young people and also people of the queer community, and they were like, well, you know, less and less bars are serving us beers and the Wolfgang.
Yeah.
I was curious about that. Yeah, because he's very adamant that he's not going to have a religious government and religious law, but I guess you can't trust that fully then. Or is it out of fear that they're not serving the booze and stuff?
I think it's out of fear. And I think it's, I mean, I'm no Syria expert. I read one amazing book, The Burning Country, that if anyone is interested in how the civil war, which not all Syrians call a civil war, went, I really urge them to read it. So I'm no Syria expert, but I think it stands for more a broader shift of values, maybe. And maybe there's no mandates determining bars to stop serving alcohol, but I guess it's a general mood that is that is shifting in the country. At least that is what the young people told me that I spoke to.
And there are certainly, I think I've heard from my contacts, that there are killings every day in Latakia, for instance, in the Alawite.
They're still going areas. On, not reported, but still going on.
Yeah, so all is not well. I mean, yes, that is, I mean, does this sound terribly kind of colonial? And please pull me up, listeners, on this if it is. But I just always think about Arabs, really. If that's, I said, how can you be so fucking lovely and be so terrible to each other on occasion? It's the most extraordinary kind of contradiction, really, that you are so genuinely fantastic, you know, so hospitable and amazing, and yet you do such terrible things to each other, really.
Well, if I can take a tiny bit of space here to talk about kind of what I've learned about borders, because that's a really big part of my trip. It's showcasing my own learning process. And one of the things that in the last months I am very much interested in is how has the West intervened to make the world as it is? And you guys as socialists should, you know, you should know this better than anyone, the force of capital in shaping how the world is looking. And I think the Middle East is really no exception. That was one main takeaway that I took out of The Burning Country, is that there was nothing fated about this sectarian breakdown. You know, same in Iraq, the Sunni-Shia divide, you know, there were intermarriages. This was not an actual divide, and it only got weaponized and activated because of the U.S. invasion and because of the U.S. war. And this is a story that is so widespread across the region that I would kind of push back on your characterization of, you know, that's just what the Arabs
sure.
do.
Yeah. No, I do. You know, I said it, but I, you know, I don't stand by it.
Well, you have one as your co-host here. And
Yes, that's true.
And any time another...
No, it's interesting. Well, it was also, wasn't it? I mean, everything is Britain's fault, really. I mean, it was also that, as I understand it, was she called Gertrude Bell or Mill? Some woman who was basically drew the borders of Iraq, and the British, they prioritized the Sunni minority to rule over the Shia. A majority, really, in that you know, in the end.
Yeah, well, at the Berlin Conference of 1885, you know, where a lot of the lines were drawn, this was also partially the goal. It was to see how they can pit different sects against each other to keep the countries. This is, for example, the case in Syria, to keep it manageable as a quote unquote mandate, aka colony for the British. You know, so it was kind of very much the point, at least there. I don't know about Iraq, but it's not unthinkable that it's the same there, you know?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. God, we were bastards. I mean, this adoration for the empire and for Britain. I mean, it's not... Well, we're not bastards. Our ruling class were bastards. Absolutely.
Same
monsters.
With the Arabs. Like, the Arabs are nice people, but it's the ruling class, and when power takes over, and especially if you've been planted there by a Western power.
Yeah.
You do, and it's like... Even my mum and dad remember a time when... Syria was multi-faith and coexist in such peace and Jewish communities. And it was even when with the Zionist argument is that the Jews were forced out of the Middle East, and that's why Israel was such an important place. A big part of that was Zionist terrorists bombing synagogues around the Middle East, creating this fear and this this division where there was none before, and it was there was intermarrying, and my mum remembers people would babysit each other's kids, and they'd be Sunni, Shia, Christian, Jewish. Doesn't matter. It's the powerful and the rich that fucking
It is. You're right there, comrade. It is the power.
Thank you, comrade.
We need to do something about that. So where do you sleep at night?
Not how, where?
No, you sleep well.
That is a very, very logistically minded question there. Well, I was going to get a hotel, but then I went to two hotels and the price was like 50 euros a night. So I'm just going to close my laptop after this conversation and head out like maybe 10 kilometers from this town. Just find a spot on a hill. I have a tiny tent and a sleeping bag. Because it's not like I get sponsored by some sort of nice company, you know. It's all bus driver money. Actually, I'm a bus driver in Amsterdam, which pays pretty well.
Already hop aboard my bus.
Yeah,
15 guilders.
Yeah, usually free. Like
hop aboard. How much is a very,
very kind bus driver in that sense. But yeah, so no, just in the wild mostly. Sometimes with people. The Kurds have been especially nice as well. It's really lovely to see the Kurdish hospitality. Before you know it, you're drinking tea and you get served some pilaf. And
amazing the hospital. Years ago, I had a flat in Borough in East London, or not East, South East London, and I had a Alfa Romeo, which the number plate was PKK, and I had a kid. Went to a Kurdish barber, but interestingly, he talked about how his grandparents, I think, remembered Sikh soldiers, because of course the British, what the British did in Kurdistan was particularly wicked, as they didn't want to station troops there, but they would. And they did this in Iraq with the Kurdish minorities, particularly. What they used flying columns of armored cars and also aircraft to bomb the Iraqi, the Kurdish tribes. A lot of British aircraft in the sort of 20s and 30s were called colonial aircraft, and that was their role really, was to head out from a base. And they also worked on our brave boys in the air for these time delayed bombs, so bombs that would be dropped and then would explode. Obviously, when they saw the planes, the Kurdish people would go into the caves. They would come out a few hours later, and that's when the bomb would go off. He just reminisced about how his grandparents were being terrorized by British Sikh troops.
It's not even 5 minutes later, and we are again at the point where we conclude, wow, the British really are the most awful people on earth. Yes.
I'm sorry. I'd like to issue an apology to just say I'm sorry. I mean, I guess it's just my ruling class. It's not me, but...
Well, same for the Dutch, though. The Dutch were also unimaginably evil in world history.
That's true, yes. You've tended to get impressive. Away with it. Yeah. And of course, the Belgians were the worst. I mean,
Leopold.
Seb, you left Amsterdam. Tell us your route and any memorable adventures that happened along this route.
Sure. So I did a lot of Europe, and then I cycled through the Balkans. Albania was very nice. And in wintertime, I ended in Bulgaria, right at the European border. So in this town called Harmanli, maybe 50 kilometers from the border to Turkey. And there I volunteered for 3 months with this organization called No Name Kitchen. They're like, you know, anarchists helping people on the move. So they have bases set up along the migration route. And the first one is in Bulgaria, because that's where people cross from Turkey into Europe through these, you know, dense forests. And I was there for 3 months. There's also a refugee camp in Harmanli. So I was working with, you know, a lot of Syrians that just arrived after, I don't know, the third or 10th time of trying and getting pushed back and beaten and their stuff stolen. And then they finally made it, and they still had this immense long journey to go. And we were there to, you know, hand out shoes or clothes and, you know, play games. And this was incredible. And it really informed, I think, a lot of my politics as well, like my anti-border politics. Made some friends. Bashar Assad fell, realized I wanted to go into Syria, and then I cycled down into Turkey, took a boat to Lebanon because I want to avoid flying, and then was in Beirut for 5 weeks exploring, you know, the Palestinian diaspora there. And Lebanon as well is a heck of a story. Oh my goodness, very complicated. From there into Syria. Sorry?
Go on, yeah. Why is that? What happened in Lebanon?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating. They don't have a shared history curriculum after 1948.
Huh.
Right? So there's no shared understanding of history. And of course, you have, you know, like a quarter is Christian, and you have the Shias, and you have the Sunnis, and you have some Druze. And so each group has a completely different read on what happened. And this makes it a total mindfuck to be in.
Right. Yeah.
It was very absurd. But yeah, learned a lot. And then from there, went into Syria, cycled across the desert in Jordan, where it was... 45, 50 degrees. And then through Iraq, same. I cycled in the nights because it was just really unbearable during the day. And now it's maybe like 35 degrees during the daytime now that I'm in northern Kurdistan or Turkey, depending on how you call it. And
you've never had any trouble with anybody ever?
Well, okay, look.
Maybe it's a vibe you give off, you know.
Before, no, I had one quite serious one. Okay, when I was in Bulgaria working with No Name Kitchen, we had a lot of shit with Bulgarian border police. They would take us and interrogate us. But that was all part of the like expectation. What happened in Lebanon, you know, in Beirut, it's a very divided city. So the Christians live there and then the Shias live there. And the Shia part of South Beirut is called Dahya. And this is the part that Israel is just bombing to smithereens. You know, like they have a whole doctrine, the 2006 Dahya doctrine, where they bomb residential buildings. So they bomb residential buildings in the hope that the population turns against Hezbollah in this case. They use it elsewhere too. Completely absurd and, you know, psychopathic. But so Dahya is the part that gets bombed. So any footage that comes out of Dahya is very sensitive because Israel is very interested to see who moves where, you know, they can the video.
Yeah.
I guess you see where this is going. They can download the video, use facial recognition, you know, whatever. And I, without knowing it, had just entered Dahya and I filmed. And then I, you know, some Hezbollah guys took me and they took my phone and then they interrogated me and then the police interrogated me. And after like 20 hours, I was cleared as, you know, having no ties to quote unquote Israel. But that was that was my only episode that was unpleasant. And the whole thing was fine. I completely understood why I was there. My fault. I had no hard feelings really about it. So, yeah.
Because I have a friend who was chained to a radiator for 5 years by Hezbollah. So. You got off pretty light, really.
Have something to eat or a drink. It's not much, but...
I'm fine.
For a cola or a Fanta, please.
No, my love, please, it's okay.
You take it and take care, okay? Travel safely. Nice to meet you. Bye.
Oh, my goodness. Bye.
Yeah. What the hell?
Being given shit?
Yeah, there was this Scottish lady and her family that inquired about me. They were sitting right, you know, like 3 meters in front of me. She's lives here for 6 years, and she just gave me this. It's Atatürk, I think, Kemal Atatürk. But that's
100.
You know, that's enough to buy a falafel. So,
whoa! Tell us your route from now on, then. Where next?
Sure. Yeah, I'm rushing to get to Georgia because I have some friends that are coming, and we're gonna bounce around. I'm really exhausted actually because I not only bike, but I try to make videos that are like meaningful and informative and, you know, anarchist oriented in their politics. And that takes a lot of brain power. So I'm pretty beat. So I'm going to have a holiday for a couple of weeks. And then I was going to go through Armenia, through Iran. Iran has been on my wish list for basically 6 years now. But yeah, I guess that's, you know, I just want to say all solidarity and compassion with
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, is the border closed? I mean, inbound to Iran?
I don't even know, but I'm in some WhatsApp groups with travelers, and it you know, the situation doesn't look good. There's some people missing, and you know, heavy interrogations. Right. And it's also like morally, like, why would I go there now? It would just be so wrong. I mean, just some statistics, right? Like, so far, 3,400 people injured in like what, 10 days. 865 killed. So yeah.
That's gone up, yeah. Shit. So Armenia and then Georgia, Armenia and then where after that?
Yeah, after Iran I was gonna go through Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan.
You're a glutton for punishment. You're really gonna go for Afghanistan, are you sure?
Yeah, well, you know, the U.S. occupations don't do magic for stable democracies. So the moment they left, the country actually, you know, turns remarkably more stable, even though there's still a massive humanitarian crisis going on. The U.S. is withholding $9 billion U.S. dollars that belongs to the Afghans.
But that's also part of the point of what you're doing, is you're going to these countries that we would never... In the West, we've been told to think you would never dream of going to these places, but it's just full of regular people who are often very nice and welcoming, and you're exposing that you know, everyone, we share more than we don't around the whole world. And I'm sure Afghanistan will be beautiful. I know people who've been to Afghanistan, and similar to the Arabs, like, you're going to eat well and you're going to be, you know, treated pretty well, unless, like in Lebanon, you know, you cross a line that you didn't know was there, or you just get really fucking unlucky.
Yeah. So Afghanistan, then where was it? And then
if I can just add on to what Talal just said, it's, you know, I try not only to show the beauty of humankind wherever we live, but taking Afghanistan, like in the 60s, Afghanistan was an immensely popular destination for like hippie people to go and, you know, smoke like really high quality marijuana. And, you know, classic US most brutal states, most terrorist state that there ever was, completely tore the country to shreds. These kinds of stories of Western involvement are also exactly the ones that I'm interested in how they have shaped our perception of the countries and how they've shaped the material conditions of the countries. Because when I told my mom I was going into Syria, she burst into tears. Because in her mind, she's, you know, progressed from now, but in her mind, Syria is just war. Like, it's just war. Like, the country is just black war. There's nothing else. So that just as an addition, like, yes, there's beautiful people everywhere, but also politics are everywhere. Western interventionism is everywhere. I mean, you know, we see it happening now again in Iran.
It's very, very good point. Very, very, I think the chimes with the, it's very on brand for this podcast. And then Japan, when do you think you'll get back to the Netherlands then?
Well, I think in like 1.5 years.
And can you go back? What's your bus route? What route do you try?
Actually, all, like 30 different ones. I have favorites.
Oh, really? You don't like just drive the 11 or something?
No, that'll be hella boring. No, actually, the planners make sure that your shift is always varied. You always have at least two lines. Yeah, it's mind-numbing otherwise, Alexi. I mean, have you ever driven a bus?
No, my best friend was a bus driver, though, and he just drove the same.
Oh, wow. There's a beauty to that, too. This is my route. I know it better than anyone. And
I suppose the routes were a lot longer in London. So, you know, he drove he's mostly on the 73s or the 9s, I think, so... Through the West End, Kensington High Street.
What's the tech like on a Dutch bus?
Do you have GPS? Presumably.
What's the tech like?
On the Netherlands buses, on the Amsterdam buses.
Would they need GPS? Why would they need GPS?
If you're changing route every day.
No,
there. So the Netherlands has this tendency to like over-technologize everything. And then that is sold as the customer experience. We have this in the public transport and, you know, the trains. Everything is super high tech and looks nice, but it's unaffordable. But you're like gaslit to think that it works really well, and you know that it's very premium. But it's just like, you know, and that's why I let people drive for free all the time, because like a basic bus ticket is, when I was still working there, like €3.50.
Oh my god,
which is like insane. So, yeah, the tech. So the tech is very high tech, very high tech. Yeah,
sounds like the buses in Newcastle. Have you seen these, Alexi? The standard buses, they've got wireless charging, USB ports.
No, you get down some of the 63, yeah.
The screens on the bus tell you all the interchanges. Like if you're going to a train station, it tells you when the trains are leaving. Is if you're going to the airport, or wait, where have I seen the airport once? It will tell you like flight details. It's like insanely high tech. And I'm like, wow, this is not what you expect in Newcastle. And before we wrap up here, Seb, I just wanted to tell Alexi and our listeners about your story in Iraq, just like run through what happened in Iraq, because it looked fucking crazy with the army helping you travel across the country and what happened there. Like, for anyone who hasn't seen it, would you mind just telling us that story?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, it's a classic case of Western interventionism making a situation unsafe. And the desert in Western Iraq is really no exception. So there's different militias that at different stages, the US and the West has armed. So as a cyclist, it's pretty dumb to cycle there. There's absolutely nothing and some militias. So what happens when you cross from Jordan is that the Iraqi army gives you an escort all the way to Baghdad, but not in one car, in like 40 different cars. And it took me 20 hours in total, because your bike and all your stuff goes from one car and then you know, to like a half tank, and then to an armored vehicle, and then to a pickup truck with a gun in the back. And every time the soldiers want to talk and want to, you know, have selfies. And by the end, I was so unbelievably fried. But yeah, it was an experience. You know, then the Iraqis have been really warm and welcoming people. So it was very much worth it. But it was intense. It was intense.
Yeah, it sounds, I'm excited. But yeah, how kind, or I mean, you know, how decent to take you all the way from the Jordanian border to Baghdad, you know, but our army wouldn't do that. Our army would just punch you in a pub. Our soldiers. I'm sorry if I meet any soldiers, I'm sorry.
Seb, you're an incredibly impressive guy, and you seem so smart and on the ball and worldly. Really grateful for you to come on.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
I look forward to your dances, Alexi. They're great, filling my feet.
Yeah, we're going to do some more. I think week after next, we're going to do some more.
Well, I'm very excited. I look forward.
What song should we do next?
Oh, God. That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe some Saint Levant. I don't know if you know him, but he's this Palestinian singer.
Oh, the Syrian
singer.
Guy. Yeah.
No, Palestinian.
Yeah. All right, we might give that a go.
I'll have a listen. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. A different...
Okay, thank you very much. Extraordinary story. And maybe we'll talk to you again when you're in Japan or somewhere.
It would be a pleasure.
That'd be a different experience.
Yeah.
I'm going to look for a camping spot. See you guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Seb.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So really interesting guy, really amazing
guy. Lovely guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we take it for granted, but the fact that we were technologically able to do it is also a miracle we shouldn't forget, really.
And he reached out to me and he said, genuinely had a blast, lovely hanging out, went with your flow, and
just comrades hanging out. Like, I'm sure, you know, he's out there on his own.
You know,
he's making friends along the way, but glad we could give him a nice experience like that. And he did, I forgot to ask him what he'd like to plug or promote, because he is he's raising funds doing this bike ride.
Yes, I didn't ask that.
He's raising funds for grassroots groups fighting borders and helping displaced people, similar to the group that he mentioned in Bulgaria, who are feeding and clothing refugees. And if you go to sebibikes.org, S-E-B-B-I-E, sebibikes.org, S-E-B-B-I-E is Sebi. You can sponsor him for a cash amount per 100 kilometers. So like you can say, I'll give you £2 per 100 kilometers, you know. And right now he's got 196 sponsors. He's raising €300 every 100 kilometers he cycles for these grassroots groups fighting borders. Sebibikes.org. Follow him at Sebibikes on all the socials. Truly lovely guy and quite heroic. Modern day explorer, you know. And speaking of, that book you mentioned, The World Beneath Your Wheels, you forgot the name of the artist. It was Walter Stoller.
Walter Stoller, that's right. He was a German prisoner of war in Britain, wasn't it? It's a very interesting book, really. I mean, in a time when people you know, actually where borders were more open than they are now, but where people didn't have, you know, didn't ride around the world. I think he's on like an old sit up on Beg rally bike, as I recall.
Yeah, and he traveled 400,000 miles.
Yeah.
For 18 years.
Wow.
159 countries. So, you know, Sebi's got big wheels to fill.
Yeah. I'd like to ask the viewers a question, actually.
Yeah.
Looking at my interview on Channel 4 News yesterday, my T-shirt looks a disgrace. Anybody... Anybody recommend, like, for the more portly gentleman, can they recommend like a black T-shirt where the neck doesn't go all kind of limp? And I mean, I did probably have crumbs down it, so that didn't help. But
there are websites that specialize in that kind of thing.
Are there?
Listeners, reach out. I'll give you some tips off air. I don't want to give any advertising. Because this is an advertising-free podcast, by the way, listeners, and we always hope to be. So please go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. To support this endeavor, chuck a few bob our way.
Please buy me when I'm in, buy me a fucking Snickers bar from the commissary when I'm locked up in Belmarsh.
Yeah. Or some cigarettes to use as currency in Belmarsh.
Yeah.
Seriously, like the price of a fucking packet of Pokemon cards a month or a cup of coffee is what they always say. What else is the cost of a cup of coffee? A falafel wrap a month goes a long way over here.
Are you getting your falafels? That's cheap.
Yeah, it is. I get a special discount, actually.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, you just speak Arabic to them.
Another incentive to learn Arabic.
Yeah. You know that street in Soho that has the market at lunchtime?
Berwick Street. Yeah.
And there's a Jerusalem falafel there.
Yeah.
Some of the best falafel, in Palestinian falafel in London. And you just go, Assalamu alaikum, kif halak, alhamdulillah, wallah, atyab falafel bil balad hada, wallah, bhab. And they go, oh, £3 extra large falafel wrap. No
so, marhaba kifalik, alhamdulillah, falafel.
Yeah, that'll get
falafel
you by.
Yani.
I swear, just show Shukran. Some.
Salam alaikum. And that'll get me a big falafel for £3.
See, this,
you know, this show isn't just informative. Well, it isn't just kind of artistically avant-garde, but it's informative as well. Just like Shakespeare.
Yeah. Yeah. There's many reasons to come here.
Yeah. Makhabaki Falek, Alhamdulillah, falafel.
My mate's working with stroke victims at the moment. He told this lovely story. There's this one fella in the clinic who doesn't speak any English. He only knows Arabic.
Yeah.
Is hardly in a talking state, speaking state, but...
my friend knows marhaba and salam alaikum and shukran, you know. And he said shukran to the guy, and he just, his face lit up. He was not expecting to hear any Arabic, you know, and he touched my friend, he put his hand on my friend's cheek, and like, you could tell it made his day. So like, you know, a little thing like that to the immigrants.
That's all you need to do.
In this country, you get so much fucking hate and... show a bit of love. This country is built on what we've stolen from other countries. So give back, you know?
Yeah. That's the other thing, though. You know, you do feel kind of, come on, Jeremy, you do feel kind of powerless, you know, even demonstrating yesterday. And the police had obviously been given instructions to be very aggressive.
Oh, God, they were really rough with everyone.
Yeah. Actually, there was a rather thrilling moment there when they tried to grab someone early on. And we all crowded around and they let them go. And it was, I was quite a few rows back, but it was the most, you could feel the blood rising, really, you know, you felt. Come on, Jeremy, where's this fucking party?
Yeah.
Fuck's sake, get your shit together. Stop fucking talking to, like, everybody. I mean, I agree it has to have a community base, but. It's getting to a point now, you can't talk to everybody and ask them what they think, like every single person. Just fucking do it. We need it now. You're going to miss the moment, I think.
Pull your finger out, Jez.
Yeah. Also, the elections, I think, for New York mayor are today, and apparently Zoran Mamdani is in the lead. We'll see, really. That would, blimey, what a turn up for the books that would be, really. You know, running against. You know, Israel lobby APAC funded opposition. It would be something to see. Anyway, we'll know by when this goes out.
He was on Stephen Colbert last night or the night before.
Okay.
Absolute cunt.
Colbert.
Yeah.
Don't really know the gentleman.
He asked him, "Do you believe Israel has the right to exist?"
Yeah, well, they all ask him that. But he has got a good reply, doesn't he? I mean,
and then he asked him, what do you say to all the Jewish citizens in New York, the largest Jewish population outside of Tel Aviv, who think that you'll be a bad for them and that they're afraid of the rise of anti-Semitism? It's the same fucking tactics, you know, that you see over and over. It's like,
yeah, but he's what's good about him is he leans into it. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't back off. He just gives his answer, you know. And so, I mean, that's the way you got to be. I mean, that was the problem with, I think, Jeremy in the early days. And it wasn't, I blame John McDonnell for this, as I said before, and Seamus Milne, that they were too apologetic. Mm. Never, you know, if you've done nothing wrong, don't apologize for things you haven't done.
Mm.
Stop apologizing for the things you've never done. It's up to us to change the town called Malice. Oh, yeah. Lying in the dairy yard and hungry housewives making clutching milk bottles to their heart, etc.
I
watched a film about the Jam. He's a good guy, Paul Weller. I watched a documentary about the Jam last night on the telly.
Congrats.
And I'm at the Style Council as well. Don't care what you say.
Is that his other band?
That was what he did after the Jam, yeah.
Style
Council.
Style Council.
Yeah.
Yeah, not heard that.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give him a listen.
Yeah.
What do you think of the Sex Pistols?
I don't know. I mean, I think Johnny Rotten's a bit of a kind of foolish clown these days. I know he was being rude about Kneecap, who we love.
He's a tool, man.
Yeah, he's a kind of...
He really enjoys being rich and being like... I imagine him at a dinner table of like rich, famous people. The novelty artist at the dinner table.
It's always that kind of... I don't know if I've ever met him really, but it's that kind of contrarian posturing, which must be exhausting after a while, I think, you know. But, you know, I didn't really particularly get... I mean, the music of the Sex Pistols was very... It was very harsh, so I think I might have bought that, the Nevermind the Bollocks album. Mm. But it's not something you would listen to particularly. Yeah, it was very important culturally, I think. Punk, it certainly made what I did a couple of years later, it made it possible, really, I think. You know, punk and then, I mean, particularly post-punk, Ian Dury and Elvis Costello made alternative comedy possible. So it was it's an important staging post on the road to where we are now.
Well, I'm going to be seeing them at Boomtown Festival, where I'm performing as well.
Sex Pistols.
Yeah, but they've rejected Johnny Rotten. They've hired a different singer.
So is it Glenn Matlock is still, is it? Stid's dead. I don't know. It's only two of them.
Some young ginger guy. Steve Jones, Paul Cook, Glenn Matlock. Oh, Frank Carter. It's Frank Carter who sings with them now. Who's this young rocker. He's
and the other
from
three
other
are still. Okay, so it's Steve Jones, Glenn Matlock and
Paul Cook.
Paul Cook.
Featuring Frank Carter, this young redhead.
All the original, yeah.
With loads of tattoos. He'll be singing with them.
Great.
Look, before we go, I've got some new Patreon names to throw at
I think that's what we're doing now, isn't it?
We're gonna give shout outs to our new patrons, man. Sorry for all the old patrons who'd who we haven't done this for, but you know, cancel your membership then rejoin. Once we reach 500, was it 500 paid members, we said we'd do a Strangers on a Podcast episode where we'll do a live streaming podcast and welcome listeners to join the stream and talk to you for a bit. But guess what, Alexi?
Yeah, what?
It looks like we've passed 500 paid members.
I mean, that took a sudden uptick, didn't it?
Yeah. It looks like we have 575 paid members. I need to look through this and confirm that. Make sure none of them are like ex-members. But also, I have to finish with Glastonbury and all that. But oh my god, yeah,
that must be the dance videos, I suppose.
Oh, hold on.
Brilliant! That's marvelous. Well, we should maybe read them all out. I don't know.
No.
Anyway, just
here's
new
some
ones.
New members. Right. We have four new members since our last podcast. And Alexi, you're going to give a special hello to each one. Yeah. Here you go. First one, Greg D.
Greggy D. Yo, in the house.
Mansell.
Thank you, brother. Oh, sister. Contributing to the pension so we can buy Hamas an 88mm flak gun. No, only joking.
No, fuck's sake.
Yvette Cooper.
Janet C.
Of course I'm not. Oh, hi, Janet. Thank you very much for contributing. I'm a professional broadcaster, you know.
Last one, Ian from Iceland.
Ian from Iceland?
Mm.
Ian from Iceland. Is that where you're called, like, after your father or your mother? So you'd be Talal Mustafa Dotson or Dottier. I don't know
if you're saying their dad is called Iceland.
No, but that's, isn't it in Iceland where, is it Iceland where you get, yeah, you know, like, so you're either called
Fredriksson in Iceland, they do
or
that,
Fredriksson or Frederick
Mustafasson.
Yeah.
Who would you be? Alexi?
I'd be Alexi Joson.
Well, this is Molly's Ian.
Or Molly's if I was a girl, I suppose.
This is Ian from Iceland, Fredriksson. Right, thanks all you new members. I'm going to have to look through and confirm we have definitely got more than 500.
That's
crazy. I'd love to do the Strangers on a Podcast episode. That's going to be a logistical nightmare. Thank you again, Sebi Bikes.
Yes, thank you, Sebi Bikes. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Free Palestine.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sell Podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisellpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.